This session, titled My Wildest Dreams, is a hilarious and uplifting conversation featuring Shirley Lay, Mandy Nolan, Oliver Pomervan, and Miff Warhurst.
We would like to thank Greenstone Partners, who is a major partner of the festival and the sponsor of this session. Please join me in welcoming our special guests for this session.
Thank you. It is my great pleasure to be sitting on this stage today with these three fabulous authors and people. Obviously people, not artificial intelligence. I'd like to acknowledge too that we are meeting here today on the lands of the Arakwal Bumbaban people of the Bundjalung Nation and acknowledge that this is and always will be Aboriginal land. Also acknowledging the long tradition of storytelling within First Nation culture and how much we have to learn about that. And I have to also acknowledge that what an amazing... Like, speaking about wildest dreams, there's a couple of things. One was, because that is the theme today is wildest dreams, and here we are in Bangalore, the first year in a new site. Hasn't it been magnificent? I love it. It is really, there's trees, it's gorgeous. I think it has been a really beautiful, and thank you everyone for, it's not always easy to make the big change, but this is a whole beautiful new site. And Bangalore being just such, I make jokes about Bangalore, but I mean them with love. Because I always go, oh my God, I can't go to Bangalore, I don't have enough linen. I'll be thrown out. I always go, don't go to the chemist. It's like so flash at the chemist. I mean, you need a prescription for a bowl. anyway, it is, but that is part of it. Bangalore is, you know, it is a beautiful place and we are so lucky to be sitting here. And it would be remiss of me when talking about my wildest dreams not to mention that last night I feel we were all united as one. Yeah. Did you feel that moment when together as a nation we held one dream? See what it feels like to be united? And it just needs a ball. Amazing. Amazing. A lot of us almost had aneurysms. Take your aspirin and you're here to do it. Like it was intense. So that was an awesome moment. So dreams can come true. And if we beat England next week, that would be even better. Anyway, just putting it out there. So today we are on My Wildest Dreams. And I would like to introduce my panellists here today, or the panellists. They're your panellists, not actually mine. I don't own them. So immediately on my left, you will know that this very fabulous panellist is Miff Warhurst, a broadcast. Yes! Much loved broadcaster, presenter, writer, and now she can say she's an author. She can say things like, when I was writing my book, in my book, you can actually get a shelf and put your book on it. It's pretty exciting, Murph. When people come over, usually I wrote a book. It's up there. It's a great memoir called Time of My Life that chronicles her stories of her life through song. So please welcome Miff Warhurst.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And in the middle, we have Oliver Pomervan, a children's author and comedian who uses his experience as a primary school teacher to inspire kids and write funny stories at schools and festivals across Australia and Asia. He's known for Tyrific and What About Tao? But in his wildest dreams, because I did ask him about that, he said he wants to be known as an expert burger blogger or part-time emo cheesy boy band called The Friend Zone.
Oh my God, that's genius.
The Friend Zone. So cute.
What are the dance moves for Friend Zone?
Just awkwardly in the corner, just staring. But not in an awkward way, just like, not in a creepy way, sorry, but just, you know, halfway creepy, so yes.
I love that. Not creepy, just kind of, yeah. You know, looking, just available. And on right on the end down there, waving to is Shirley Lee, a Vietnamese Australian writer and member of the Sweatshop Writers Collective, a Western Sydney literacy movement. Her book Funny Ethnics was published by Affirm Press, and it's her first novel, and is physical evidence that wildest dreams do come true. So put your hands together. Okay, so here we are, getting close to the end of the day. So I'm going to go back because this is called Wildest Dreams, right? And so, and I'm going to throw to anyone who wants to start this one because I'd like you all to answer this. So as writers, you know, in your wildest dreams, because tell me a little bit, because we want to know where you grew up and what it was like, and in your wildest dream, what you envisaged life was going to be like, and did you ever imagine you'd be here talking to people who are almost retired but can't because they've raised the retirement age and now will have to work for the rest of their lives. So tell me, where did you grow up? What was it like? And what were your wildest dreams as a kid? Do you want to start, Oliver?
So I grew up in Canny Vale near Cabramatta, southwest Sydney, and my dream was to be a dinosaur. That was my dream. I wanted to bite kids and slash them with my hands, and my dream was to be a palaeontologist and have my own dinosaur called the Oliverosaurus, but I realised I couldn't be one because I couldn't spell it, so had to be a writer instead. But look, honestly, I wanted just to write stories that I could actually see myself in them, because growing up, there weren't too many books that had characters that kind of looked like me. So growing up as a bit of a class clown, I knew I wanted to write funny stories. And so I would say that, yes, you know, they say that being an author is a dream come true. And I've got to say, it is. Like, even after 13 years, it still feels like I'm at a festival and I have to act like it could be my last one. It could be my last one. So, you know, I'm grateful to be here. So, yeah.
Thank you, Oliver.
Yeah.
Yay. Shirley, what about you?
I grew up in a small city called Yaguna. Which is not actually too far from Canleyville, where you grew up, Oliver. Mm. And it's a city in Western Sydney.
I think we just need the level on your microphone.
Is that something that I can...
Oh, there we go.
Oh, there we go. Back.
There we go.
I tell you what it was, Shirley, you just weren't turned on. And there's a lot of women in the audience that know that sometimes that is the problem. But you just push on.
I'm not sure what panel I'm on here. Is this Wildest Fantasies?
I'm taking notes now, actually. How to turn women on.
Sorry, Shirley, that is really off-putting of me to do that. But I don't have any filters, Shirley, so I should tell you that. So, Shirley, we're going to tell me about where you came from, where you grew up, and what your wildest dream was.
I grew up in Yaguna, which is a place in southwestern Sydney, and it's not too far from where you grew up, Oliver, and I didn't really see myself represented in the books or TV shows or films that I watched, and I think my wildest dreams was just to be a part of the Saddle Club. part of the Saddle Club. And it is an absolutely wild dream to have a book out there in the world and to be able to speak at festivals like this. And growing up, I thought Yaguna was like a place where art and culture went to die. But no, I think Western Sydney nowadays is a place where art and culture thrives, and so many voices from Western Sydney are influencing Australian arts and culture, and I'm so proud and happy to be part of that.
Yeah. Yay! I actually think that's such a powerful statement, Shirley, because, you know, so often part of the... I guess in almost the Australian humour vernacular is to make fun and jokes of suburbs, you know, like Western Sydney, without actually realising, you know, who's there and what's actually happening there. So good on you for high-fiving Western Sydney. Miff?
Oh, goodness me. I grew up in various country towns in Victoria, born in Portland on the coast towards South Australia, famous for its Alcoa smelter. Then we moved to Central Victoria, Donald, in and that's sort of in the middle, right in the middle, and then sort of my late sort of from about 8 years on until I was a teenager and moved away, I lived in a place called Redcliffs, which is up near Mildura, if you know that. That was our big smoke. And our big smoke was actually Adelaide because that was 6 hours away. And so, yeah, very country town existence. And it was also, I'm way older than you two, there was no internet back in those days, which feels like the absolute dark ages now. So it was quite difficult to access information about the rest of the world, really. So I think that's probably where my obsession with television and music came from, because for me it was a way to access the wider world and to start dreaming big and having ideas about how I might want to live or what I might wanted to be. I mean, I just read loads of books and consumed as much as I could, which was pretty limited, which was like Dolly Magazine and Smash Hits at the news agency. And, yeah, and Countdown on the telly, any music show I could get my eyes on.
My God, because you had a job at the news agency.
I did have a job at the local news agents too, yes.
And that when you're in a country town, that's like... You that know, is the best job.
Absolutely. We sold Lotto too. I was 14. It wasn't illegal back in those days to have someone under the age of 18 sell Lotto, and we did it lots of times. But, yeah, you know everyone's business in the small country town. So that was and they know yours, which I think is something I didn't necessarily enjoy when I was younger. I wanted the independence and the autonomy of a big city, which I eventually got, but I'll always love. I love what I experienced in that country upbringing and the fact that it gave me the love of reading and writing and popular culture, because I think that's probably where it all started for me. So, yeah, it's a great honour to be at... This is my only book festival. I released this last year and then I went on the road with Rocky Horror and I haven't stopped until last week. So I'm pretty sure this is my one and only book festival appearance. So you guys are lucky.
Yay! Well, we're so happy about that. I also love the fact that... I don't want to be rude, but...
But
I was talking about, but none of you come from anywhere cool. Do you know what I mean? And I think that turns up in your writing is that...
No, I get it.
And you know what I'm saying is that you're writing, you know, like none of your characters are growing up in Watergoose in Byron Bay. And I know why. It's because no one would care about them. You know, because they're affluent and they've got too many opportunities there. But how important in your writing was the place that you all wrote from in talking about your wildest dreams? Because obviously the places that you came from probably didn't feel like places where... I know, because I come from a town called Wandai, which means wild dog. and I have to admit, I resonated because I knew it felt like to be this lonely girl looking at the Sacred Heart of Jesus, hoping at night that I could... go through the glowing portal to somewhere better. I didn't even get a job at the news agent.
Oh, look, it wasn't Sports Girl. I wasn't cool enough for Sports Girl. There was one shop in the Big Smoke. And we
That's true. That's be lucky to get you. Your next stop was the TAB for you, Miff. So tell me, how important was... When you're writing in your books and in your own personal stories was place, where you wrote to, particularly in the books. So they were very, your sense of place was very evocative in your writing and how you wrote to that without, oh, that baby loves it, without calling it, without demeaning it at the same time. Because I've made that mistake and people have the internet and they will get in touch with you. Shirley?
For me, place is actually no different to a character in a book. And so there's a literary... I know, I think I'm going to be the nerdy one on the panel today. I don't have a comedy background like the rest of the panel, so I'm just funny, but funny for a writer, not a comedian. So there's this literary... there's a literary technique called pathetic fallacy, where the emotions of the character is mirrored in the weather or the general environment in a story. And so I really thought about pathetic fallacy in terms of Yuguna. And so when Sylvia Nguyen, the protagonist of Funny Ethnics, feels... she feels a rage at Yuguna for not being cool enough, for not being big enough to hold her dreams, Yuguna answers in kind. And I mirror that in how Yuguna, the sun in Yuguna, is like beating down on Sylvia's back and things like that. So for me, Yuguna becomes a character and Yuguna communicates to the protagonist in various ways.
Oh,
I like that.
Thank you. Shirley, and I've just learnt, was it pathetic fallacy?
Yes.
Oh, my God, that looks like, this is like something you would have said to the former government. Oliver?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I will always live in Western Sydney because I can't afford to live anywhere else, so I'm stuck there. So I might as well write about it. And look, I'm from Shirley as well. I feel like, you know, coming from a kids' writer point of view, kids lose it when I actually mention Cabramatta, Fairfield, Liverpool in the stories. They're like, oh, wow, you actually, like, wrote about, like, why? What'd you do that for? Like, no, I want to write that because, you know, for a lot of kids, that, like, it's that sense of shame or sense of, like, oh, you know, my place is too small. But I want to sort of bring the spotlight on that as well. And so that's why I'm really proud to see so many really cool writers come out of Western Sydney, because there's so many untold stories and this sort of cultural melting pot here sort of waiting to be told. And there's a lot of quirks as well. So, like, you know, Bangalore's got its quirks as well. Come down to, like, you know, somewhere like Cabramatta or Liverpool, where, you know, you will have, like, so many, like, Asian discount stores, so many cool places where you can get stuff that's really, really cheap, like, actually cheap, if you know what I mean. And I reach you a very small part about that dagginess of, like, having... being forced by my parents to get stationery from those stores instead of, like, proper stores like Big W or Kmart or The Reject Shop. Oh, that was really, like, high-class stuff there. So that's what I really wanted. So, but, yeah, like, you know, like you said, the place does become a different character and it sort of ties in quite well with my writing. And I love travelling as well. So wherever I go around, I'm always thinking about stories. And in my later story, What About Tao?, it's about this city kid who's Asian living in a very small town called Magala, which is totally made up, but it's a love letter to all the country towns I've visited over the years, because I find that in those towns there's so much hospitality, but there's also so many, like, hidden stories out there as well that there's just waiting to be told, and I'm just sort of going to pluck them as well. So, yeah.
Absolutely. It is, and often we don't get a chance to go into those towns because they ask, you know, and you, we often do, you know, we don't understand them. I don't know if anyone... been to Thargaminda? Have you? There's some people, they call it Thargo, which sounds really kind of exotic, but it's a little tiny country town sort of on the edge of the Simpson Desert in Channel Country that was welcoming refugees there that have now created their own kind of housing cooperative to address housing issues, and they run on completely renewable energy because they're powered by thermal water. There's 400 people in the electorate and a beekeeper is the mayor. it sounds like I made it up, but it exists. Anyway, that's the magic of some of these remote regions. And yeah. You write about that too, Miff.
Oh, yeah. And I'm really appreciative of where I grew up. You know, like when you're a kid, not necessarily so, but it gave me a lot of who I am today. And I think that's the same as... for you both as well, all of us to a certain extent, the place where we live is, we don't get a choice as kids, and you make the best of it however it comes. And I, you know, as much as I didn't want to live there at that time necessarily, what I wanted to get out, I still look back with absolute affection for the little town that I grew up in, because, yeah, it gave me so much of who I became in so many ways. And that might be, you know, my love of cheesy music that other people can relate to, you know. We don't all come from cool backgrounds, or we didn't at least.
I love
then.
That admission in your book, Miff, because in your industry, I mean, you're working with super cool people.
Yeah, and when you tell them that your favourite artists are Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton, you know, 10, 20 years ago, that was not cool. These days, it's a lot cooler to love Dolly, but, like, way back then, no.
Oh, I and it is true. It is absolutely. We're there. You found, and it's hard not to start tapping along when Galveston comes on or something. When you know, going, I do like country music. Don't tell anyone. as it is. So you all of you, one sort of commonality that you've all done in My Wildest Dreams. It's funny to bring, but you've all written with great humour, pathos, sometimes kindness. A lot of kindness, but sometimes is our families, when we're writing, often our families are the front line, right? And we go to them to go, okay, you're up for it. Can you tell me how you approach writing about your family and a little bit about who the characters, whether it's you've fictionalised them or whether it's somehow, and who was the most annoying family member for you growing up that you might have used in this book? Ooh. Can I start with you, Oliver?
It would have to be my mum, I think. Like, horrific essentially yes. is a list of embarrassing things that my mum did to me when I was a kid. And it got so many, I had to write a sequel as well. And that was just barely covering the surface. And, you know, my mum is that typical Asian mum who loves to haggle. Even at Woolies, she'll be there like, come on, I'm going to pay cash. You know, cash is king. And she struggles now because a lot of the self-checkouts, they can't really speak. So I keep telling my mum, you can try touching the screen all you want, but you're not going to get any more extra discount there. But she does try. But yeah, like I think my mum, which I'll read it up later on, is like she's that typical mum who loves to wear her heart on her sleeve. And that is, she loves to cook Thai food. And I was always being brought Thai food to school all the time. And you know, parents at school are just uncool in general, but my mum would come into eating time during lunchtime and actually give me my lunch, which was always fresh Thai food. Oh. Smelled great, but it was like, oh, mum, this is so embarrassing. And actually, the principal actually had to ban parents coming in during eating time because it got too disruptive. And so my mum said, oh, here's an idea, Oliver. Before eating time, just pretend you got to go to the bathroom. And then, okay, and then she would meet me at the front gate and then she would feed me my lunch through the fence, the holes of the fence. And I'm like, I was a little bird being fed. And that was up until I was in grade 8. So, yeah, so it's very tough. But, you know, it's enduring. And look, here's the thing. We always love to poke fun at people that we love the most. Well, that's what I keep telling myself anyway. So, yeah.
Actually, that's beautiful. And if someone does make fun of you who's a writer in your family, it is an act of love. You have been selected. Miff, what about for you in your book?
I tried to keep it mostly about me in that sense because it was, I feel a certain responsibility because I feel like a lot of our memories are collective memories to a certain extent. The things that we remember from our childhood are not necessarily real. It's a combination of like lots of people's ideas about what happened in that situation. So I've tried to keep it fairly broad. I mean, there was all sorts of things my brothers did to me. I had three older brothers. I've only listed farting on my pillow before I go to bed as possibly the one thing that they would do that was awful. I was pretty good to them, really, in the book.
That's good. That is I just reminded me of a terrible farting moment that I did. Sorry, I shouldn't tell you this. This is too much disclosure, but I just remembered from that of... It was not my sibling, it was a cousin. And my cousin, his sister and I, farted in his face until he had an asthma attack. And then we said, we will not get an adult until you promise not to dob. He didn't dob. We did get an adult eventually. He's okay. You'll be glad to know. He's a cop now.
He learnt not to snitch real quick, didn't
right.
he?
Right. It's a really great way of actually wearing down an opponent. Sorry, Miff. I had a little moment. Shirley, what about for you?
Look, when Funny Ethnics came out, I genuinely was quite scared that my parents would disown me. As a child, my parents did realise that I really liked to read and write, and so they really supported me in that. But when I started to, you know, do wild things like enroll in an arts degree, they were like, okay, that's getting a little bit too far now. Like, you know, we thought you'd just become a lawyer or an accountant, like, you know, normal Asians do. But look, I've tried to approach, you know, the parent figures in Funny Ethnics with respect. I think it's important to show that compassion towards especially elder generations within my community. Having said that, yes, there are funny bits in there that kind of show how there's friction in the relationship between a first generation Vietnamese Australian and a second generation Vietnamese Australian like myself. My parents surprisingly haven't disowned me. Instead, they, you know, show off about the book quite a bit, and they're like, oh, you know, our daughter, Shirley Lee, like, she dropped out of law school, but she wrote a book. But it's fiction. It's fiction. It's a fictional book. It's fiction. So, yes, my parents love to... That's their standard line about Funny Ethnics. I forgot the rest of the question, Mandy. Can you refresh my memory?
You actually answered it. You actually answered it perfectly. So that was good. So I would love it because, you know, and this is the only panel I've actually asked for anyone to do a reading on, because I think each of your book has such a beautiful, humorous flavour and tone, and I'd really love people after this session to go and buy them because they're such great pieces of writing. I've asked each of the authors just to select a small piece to actually read so you get a feel of what the book is. So strap yourselves in. Imagine, you can even close your eyes if you like. You're in your car. No, you don't close your eyes when you're driving. imagine it's like an audio book. Would you like to start? Who'd like to start? Are you ready? Is anyone ready with their little the book open?
I can do the bit if
okay,
you.
Okay, go, Miff.
Yeah. You picked this bit out because you thought it would work with the audience today, because of course it's the place where Olivia Newton-John resided, obviously, and being a little country girl watching, growing up and watching Countdown, Olivia Newton-John was like the goddess.
And everyone here would have. Did you all see Olivia going, wow?
I was obsessed with Olivia Newton-John. I don't think I'd even seen Grease at this stage, too grown up for me. But the gorgeous Australian blonde in the lead role of Sandy was all over the television. Let's not focus right now on the fact that the entire message of Grease is that you have to change who you are for the hot boy to finally love you. Instead, let's just focus on the brilliance that is the magnetic Olivia. She was at the prime of her life, an Australian who would become an international superstar. To me, she was everything. Xanadu, a film about love and roller skating, what's not to love, was a commercial and critical flop at the time, but as I'd never seen it, only the music video clips on TV, again, I was too young for the movie, I thought it must be a masterpiece. Watching it later, I realised it wasn't, but no biggie. I'd ask for some roller skates for Christmas, and getting the Xanadu record was the next step to me fully evolving into an Olivia Newton-John type figure in my mind. She was impossibly beautiful, with a singing voice that could soothe and also terrify any cats within earshot when she sang that high note at the end of the song Xanadu. You know the one? Xanadu! That one. It hurts. She does it amazingly well. In my young, unformed mind, Olivia was what the perfect woman should look like, how they should present, how I should be. Of course, I looked nothing like her, and the realisation that I never would was yet to dawn. But Australian TV was extremely white bread at the time, with few women in starring roles, and those who were had a look and a body type that I hadn't quite realised would never be attainable for me. 5 foot nothing and slightly round. Shall I keep going? That was sort of where we said we'd stop.
Is there a little bit more? I think that's...
Yeah.
All right.
No, good.
No, okay,
good.
Thank you. We want you to keep reading by buying the book. I love that moment of Xanadu. Do you remember that note? I want to hear you all sing it. Can you lead us in that myth?
Oh, my God.
Wait, Xanadu. I can't sing. Xanadu. Now we are here in Xanadu.
You've got the now that I'm here. Now that you're near.
and
Xanadu, now that I'm here, now that you're near. In Xanadu, do it. Xanadu.
Oh, yes.
That was actually really good. Well done, everyone.
Oh, I love you. You are fucking awful. But you are beautiful.
I can't believe I just did that too in front of people.
No. I love that. Do you know what? I like karaoke. I hate when people with good voices do karaoke. I think they ruin it. Karaoke is for the express purpose of people who are tone deaf. Thank you very much. All right. Sorry, I won't make everyone sing songs after that. It just felt too special not to have a little Xanadu. Oliver?
Yeah.
You could have had it ready, Oliver, but never mind.
Baby, when I met you, we were pigs on. You mentioned karaoke. I love karaoke. So okay, here we go. I headed on trains when Asians speak in their own language. It makes me paranoid that they're speaking about me, especially with my own family. Mum pulls out the headphone from my left ear. Tonga Bali Pusa Thai. Look, there is no way I'm speaking Thai in public. My looks and surname are bad enough. Mum says something else in Thai, but I just keep looking out the train window, blasting out the music on my player. It's still not as loud as Mum's Life's Terrific t-shirt. I wish I had one that said, not for me. She pops out the other headphone. We're only getting things you really need for school. Mum and Dad are not poor. They're just cheapskates. I'd not got sent home with a list of things I need for high school. I wrote some extra things down at the bottom, like a U pencil case and school bag. The train stops at Liverpool Station. Gitch Sai, my little brother, leaps out of his seat and makes his own announcement. Masanita loholofe lao, Gitsai says. Mum claps her hand. Good boy. What's Liverpool in Thai, I say. Mum just shakes her head. There were some words that don't have a Thai translation, like McDonald's, Billabong, or Coca-Cola. All the cool things in life. We leave the station and walk towards the U Office Work store. Their back-to-school ads are spooky. Kids are smiling with brand new pencil cases and bags. Forget about the junk food ads. These are the ones that should be banned. No normal kid is happy to go back to school. As Mum goes across the road, I grab her arm. Hey, office work is that way. Office work is too expensive, Mum says. Expensive, I scratch my head. They're selling 10 pencils for 10 cents. We walk past the mega shopping center. The automatic doors swing open, but Mum doesn't go in. Where are we going? Just keep walking. It's just down the street, Mum says. I see the stores and my head shrinks between my shoulders. Crazy Bargains, Golo, The Reject Shop. But Mum doesn't stop. The stores get even cheaper. The $2 shop, everything's $2, $2 only. I count 30 bucks worth of $2 shops. We turn down into a creepy alley. I think we're going to get our stuff from the back of a truck. I'm wrong. It's my worst nightmare. It's an Asian discount store. Mum, are you crazy? I poke my head out of my jacket. They don't sell school stuff here. It looks like Office Works, Gitsai says. You're in year three now. I lift up his chin. Read the sign. Gitsai rubs his eyes and looks up again. I can't read Chinese. Well, it's not Office Works. It's more like you'd be lucky if it works. You can't read Chinese. Well, it's close enough.
That's my... Oh, welcome. Oh, that is such an evocative journey that you just took us on there. I have to admit, though, as talking about wildest dreams, everyone's got their special thing that they love. And actually, when you said that, I went, mine is Officeworks. Mm. Does anyone else have that? I go into Officeworks and I go, oh, my God, my life could be so much better. If only I found a complete colour-coded filing system with stick-on post-it notes that I can order myself in. And do you do that? Meet me after. I'd never thought about that. That's really... Do you go to Officeworks now?
I wish I could, but I can't afford it. It's, someday.
Yeah, one day. Okay, Shirley?
Tampons weren't only for periods. You could stuff them up your nostrils for nosebleeds too. My best friend Tammy showed me. We were in year 10 when I lifted my lunchbox out of my school bag and a pad was stuck along the bottom of the container like a stranded stingray. Tammy laughed so hard that tears dripped down her wide cheekbones and funneled towards her pointy chin. After school, she took me to the Woolies near Central Station to buy tampons. I was drawn to the ones that came sheathed in orange, blue and purple covers, cheerful as jelly beans. Mini or super? I asked Tammy. In the Hong Kong martial arts films that my parents rented from Cabramatta, kung fu masters stroked their beards when they had something profound to say. Tammy had her own version of that. She tucked her hands into her sweater because her skinny ass was always cold and used both sleeves to defrizz the hair on either side of her face. And from her puffy lips, she uttered a profound answer to my question. Mini, duh, we're Asian, so like... We're meant to have smaller ones. I snatched the colourful box from the shelf. Later on the train, I shoved it inside a hidden pocket in my school bag where Mum wouldn't find it. Mum didn't explain why I was only allowed to use pads, but I could piece together her thought process. Tampon in vagina equals penis in vagina equals pregnant equals having to organise a teen wedding in your backyard with durian cake and a whole roast pig to save face, even though all the Viets down in Saigon Place were gossiping in hushed tones about how you raised a hoe.
As you can see, Shirley, who declares herself not to be funny, is very sneaky. Her book is full of those very, very funny stories like that, which I love. I think a lot of women have, some of the older women, there was this great pad, I'm going to go to the big long pad story, but some of the ladies here will be old enough to remember when you had to, you had that weird pad incineration.
Oh, yes. At school.
You actually had to burn at school. You had to burn them. You won't know anything about this, Oliver, but you had to burn, you came out and you had to burn your shame in what was like a mini incinerator.
Yes.
And it was like one of those papal announcements where it sends like
true.
Someone with a broken vagina in here.
And they had the incinerator at the back as well, where yeah, like the caretaker of primary school or high school would just be out there chucking asbestos on it.
It was all around. We burnt heaps. No wonder there's no ozone. We were just burning stuff. Thank you. That was really great. I really enjoyed that. Give them a hand because that was really... You all write about adolescence. It's a key theme in your book. And I want to know, and we're talking a little bit around that, but what kind of teenager were you? Were you... It's all right. Just answer the phone. It's okay. It's always fun. Is it embarrassing when that happens? If it's an organ donation or something, you can answer. Don't just put it on. Don't put that off for us. I remember once, I was just like, people always think I was like a real badass at school, but I was actually the opposite. I was like that really irritating girl at school, and I did this at all because I got five kids. They're in the car. And I remember telling them, because none of them were really, like, I was a super high achieving, because it was the only way out of this shithole of a town I lived in, was to actually be, and, you know, we were very poor. Mum was a single mum. And I was very creative. And I remember going to school in year eight and I had to give a talk on cats, right, and I dressed as a cat. And I told... Far out. And I... There is no way, like, my daughter, I told my eldest daughter, and she goes, I would have totally bullied you. and I respect that. So what type of adolescence were you?
Well, I mean, look, where did I even start? I think I was, like, across all the boards of, like, just weirdness in general. So, like, you know, I was like the Power Rangers of Fringe. So it's like, you know, combined with like nerd, being an Asian, looking like a geek, also being like, you know, part of the friend zone and like being rejected by girls as well. And loving like, you know, plush toys and Pokemon and all that kind of stuff. So it's just like a whole lot of nothing, basically. It's just a whole lot of like weirdness. But I loved it. I mean, I loved it in the sense of like I was also a bit of a class clown as well, and I upgraded to becoming a chameleon, which meant I could boss other people to do silly stuff, and it was really good. and, you know, I really found myself wanting to be the center of attention. One of the greatest things I did was kind of similar. I was inspired by an old show called Good News Week with Paul McDermott. And he used to read like newspaper articles and his jokes, and then he would chuck them in the air. And I did that, actually. What I did was I actually printed like printed and I cut out 1,000 cue cards that were blank. And I was just made up my speeches on the spot like a stand-up comedy. And then I would aim it at the fan and it would just get everywhere like confetti. And that was my dream come true many times. And that was really cool. So, yeah, I was basically one of those awkward kids. But awkward in the sense of like, you know, in the background. But when... The spot was on me doing something like, you know, something like being on a panel like here or even just doing a speech in front of everyone. That's when I just sort of became that kind of like sly, on edge kind of comedian kind of stance. So, yeah.
Oh, I love that. You did let slip in there was plush toys. Did you?
Yes. I bring my Grubby Bear Care Bear with me and I tell kids that it's my oldest toy, so that's why I show it. But seriously, it's my security blanket.
That's adorable. I wish you'd bought it.
Yeah.
They're worth a lot of money now too, Care Bears. You got it.
So, Miff, what kind of adolescent were you? Because you've grown up in a household full of boys, too, yeah. And growing up as the youngest girl in a house of boys can be very formative in how you approach the world.
Yeah, it was pretty rough and tumble, to be honest. And I think I just adapted to the way they lived and became one of them, I guess. But it was funny. My folks were quite upstanding members of the community. Dad was the school principal and Mum taught at the school.
They are the school.
And the school was like... Yeah, the school was 200 kids. So, you know, there was like 15 people in my class. So you couldn't get away from your parents knowing your business as well. And normally I think most kids would probably hate it. But all that did for... all of us, it just made us really sneaky and do some really naughty stuff without getting caught. So I think it gave me a sense of, you know, taking things to the edges, being a little bit naughty and having a bit of fun with it as well. And I think that hugely influenced, because I was, you know, when you grow up with three boys, you are quite sort of, you're up for it, you know. And,
yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that had a huge impact on who I became, because I still love to have a good time and, you know, be a bit naughty sometimes and all those things.
You've had a career.
That make it fun.
That has
you
been
know?
Your actual career, actually.
Yeah, you make it fun.
Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You get in there, have a bit of fun and be a bit naughty.
Yeah.
And then you get paid.
Exactly. There's my wildest dream right there.
That is awesome. Shirley?
Look, I think I was born 40. I've always... kind of just had the same, like, flatline personality. I remember in high school, at the end of year 12, we have a yearbook, and every girl's... yes, I went to a girl's school, if that wasn't abundantly clear. So there was a yearbook that listed out every girl in the grade's name, and beside that it would be, like, oh, she is most likely to become, like, the next Nicole Kidman and stuff like that. And beside my name, there was no occupation or anything. It was just like, oh, Shirley Lee, most likely to still be very mature. Yeah, just really, I've always been old. yes. So when you said that I wasn't turned on, that was not quite correct.
Touché, Shirley. Touché.
I like things to come full circle. It's also a literary technique, but anyway, I won't go into that.
It's actually a comedy technique too, Shirley. It's called a call. What do you call it? It's probably
callback.
Callback. Yeah, we call it callbacks. What do you call it?
There's something called a metaphorical network where all your metaphors, all your metaphors in your piece of writing connect with each other, therefore giving it a vibe of circularity.
Oh, thank you.
We have an actual writer in our midst.
I'm going to have to write that down.
Vibe is not a technical term in literature, by the way. I just sprinkled that in there, but anyway.
I love that because we've been doing callbacks for probably all our career and realised we were doing metaphorical full circles. It's kind of like, isn't it? It's like the metaphorical version of doing lappies in a car in a small town. Which will be a thing of the past soon when we're in electric vehicles. So I just wanted to reflect then to Oliver and Shirley, just a slightly more serious topic, which is, you know, we are talking My Wildest Dreams, and you did both mention in the beginning when you started talking, you were talking about the reason that you wrote was because you didn't see yourself represented in anything that you wrote. What was it like being a young person growing up in an Australia where you don't see yourself? Like, how do you find dreams in a place like that? And how important is it to have strong, you know, books, role models, characters, voices on the radio, faces on the news? How much does that change what you can see for who you can become? Heaps.
Yeah, I definitely didn't think that being an author was something that was possible for me. I found it very difficult to even bring myself to drop out of a whole law degree and pursue the arts. And so it is really important because there's this quite simple saying, you can't be what you can't see. And so for me, I think storytelling and being able to hold a pen and to write your own story on your own terms, that's a power and that's a privilege. And I'll never forget that when I approach art making.
Yeah, I guess for me, like, it was always in my subconscious. I never really thought about it, but it was always in the back of my head. I was reading books by Paul Jennings and Robin Klein and Morris Gleitzman. And the fact that, like, yeah, a lot of the kids I saw myself in, like, I didn't identify through culture, but I still identified through, like, you know, having an embarrassing family or wanting to be popular and wanting to be, you know, wanting to belong. And that themes have carried on through my writing. So, you know, when I write about Asian Australian characters, you know, it is about culture and about my family, but at the same time, it's also about other universal things, about, like, you know, cringe and about wanting that girl that, you know, that you've been pining for, or, you know, trying to actually, like, become, you know, popular. And so those kind of feelings that are universal are still right in my books. But I get a real sense of a joy visiting schools that have Asian kids in them, and the kids look up to me because I'm taller than them. And and they say, wow, I could be an author just like you and make tens and tens of dollars. I'm like, yes, that's right. Have you got any spare cash for some bus fare, please? But honestly, it is so. I mean, over the last years, I love the fact that kids can actually see themselves in writers such as, like, you know, There's so many cool Australian Asian writers out there in the kids lit world, like you know, Gabrielle Wang. You got like Ahn Do. You got so many other people out there now, and they're paving the way. And what I love the fact is that like there's other people coming to the forefront to stepping up as well. So I'm really happy to sort of be part of that. So yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you now, and I probably should have prepped you for this, but I haven't. It's because sometimes it's hard to think of it straight away. So I'm going to ask you the question and I'll probably tell a tiny story while you do the thinking, right? And that is, because I only just thought of it now, that's why. I just went, I'm just going to ask that. Because part of, you know, we talk about our wildest dreams as if it's this thing that we can attain without risk and without failure and without not quite getting there. So I want you to think back and to, it can be a moment in your life where you didn't get there, where you didn't make it, and where you had to push it, or a struggle or a challenge that you've had to deal with or push through that I'd like you to share. And I'm going to give you a quick one, a very quick one of mine while you're ding, 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 ding. That's your thinking time. I got a job around this when I first moved to this region, and I lied about being able to drive. That's not cool. It's my old boss here. She was here yesterday. They realised and they let me, you know, I said I could drive, but I had to learn it. So it was a really good job. I loved it. And after 6 months, they realised that probably I couldn't drive. So I had to get a licence. It was probably my early 20s. And I go to a driving school, and it's an older driving instructor who's a little bit intense. He used to say, you remind me of another, who's English, another Mandy I used to teach, Mandy Rice Davies. I went, what? That was kind of a bit off left field. Anyway, it was a bit odd. Anyway, I failed the test 3 times. This one used to have to go up that Mwilumbah Road to the Mwilumbah. I was 23, that Mwilumbah RTA. Anyway, I'm driving up for my third test and I've failed and failed and failed. And as I'm wearing a sundress, it was hot and it was just done up at the back. And as I'm driving, the button explodes. Not kidding. And the whole dress just fell to my waist. And my boobs are just out. And this guy, have you ever seen a dude's, like, in a cartoon, you see their eyes go, like, they literally popped out of his head and went, nah. And I got my hands off the wheel and went like this. On that windy road, and he goes, no, no, 10 to 2, 10 to 2. It's a totally true story. So I had to drive all the way to the RTA with my tits out. And I tell you what, when I drove back, that's how I went home. No, I got my license. But that. Thank you. All right, that's just a terrible moment in my life. It was very shameful. Okay. Shame, a little bit of shame.
I just want to say before we even start telling the stories, I've been sacked because I work in television and radio so many times. It's like, oh, which one? Because you do, you know, you get contracts and they go for a year or two here and there if you do radio, and then someone gets sick of you and someone gets replaced and you're out. And it's sort of become, failure actually becomes part of your story in a way. If you're not sacked, I kind of look at people and go, what's wrong with them?
Well, yeah, they're not pushing up.
Yeah. Or no, they're really good at their job, unlike me. But yeah, that was just the first thought that came into my head. But it is hard to deal with the failures, because they're often, when you work in the media or you're a public person, they can be brutal. Like, I think about even recently, you know, like talking of wildest dreams, and if you're waiting for this for the last question, I haven't got an answer because I'm going there now.
That's okay. No, you, it's cool.
You know, if I'd told that little girl who was 13 or 15 or whatever, who was obsessed with all sorts of pop music, didn't matter what it was, and might have been obsessed with Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue and knew all the words to Especially For You, if you'd told her at that age that she would have been doing a musical with Jason Donovan when she was 50, you're like, no fucking way. No way would that be real. And in a way, like, I've got to live those wildest dreams. But with that, it never comes easy. You know, like, you do a show and I was just the narrator in the Rocky Horror Show. I have no acting experience. I have no idea, you know, really what I'm doing. But that role doesn't really require it. But then it was like I was having such a good time. I'm living my best life, living my, you know, the greatest dreams, going, I can't believe this is real. Who is she? And then you get the reviews. And they say you're shit. And you're like, oh, no, can't I just have one thing that's fun and everybody just can enjoy it? But it never works out like that. That's the thing. It's never perfect. Nothing ever turns out perfectly. And I wish it would, but it just doesn't.
I know. And it's true. And there is it's a really funny but poignant story of when you got such a hard time for that one-arm dress you wear to the Logies.
Yes.
And I go.
I thought I looked beautiful.
I actually went, you know what, I went, I would have worn that.
Yeah.
Thought you looked great, but you got...
It just depends, you know, like that's the thing. It can be dependent on whether or not someone likes you at that point or they've got a thing against you. It's all stuff you can't control. The only thing you can control is yourself. And you have to learn to kind of take the hits as it comes. And that's the horrible part about it, really. It'd be lovely if it was all...
But it's much more interesting to read about that.
True. True. I agree. I buy those books.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Oliver?
I almost failed my first prac being a primary school teacher. And
that's your mother, Oliver.
Yes, I know. Where are you, Oliver? I thought you should be going to get the milk, but no, not here. She couldn't be here because she's playing the pokies in another... Just like that. But yes, basically, like, I almost failed my first prac, and it was because I was just like, I didn't vibe with my prac teacher. And what got me through that was Jesse McCartney, Beautiful Soul, that song. I was driving on the way to this school and just listening to that song over and over again. And it made me realize that cheesy pop songs really did save my life. And it saved me in that prac because I was on the verge of tears after having this disastrous 45-minute handwriting lesson, and I was teaching these kids handwriting on a whiteboard, and I was so nervous that as I was writing it, my sweat smudged the whiteboard as well. So it's just this cycle of just like, and I was like, oh. And this was like 10 years before everyone discovered, you know, they could just do that on an iPad and makes writing, you know, to purpose now. But yeah, I was on the verge of tears. I was going to fail. But in the last week, I just said, you know what, if I'm going to fail, let me fail in style. So what I did every single morning, I just put on like a cheesy boy band song like Westlife, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, and I'll just come in dancing and nobody cared. And the kids looked at me and they're like, what's this going on here? And so I took that mantra of like just not caring and showing a lot of myself. And look, on Wednesday here at the Byron Writers Festival, I was in front of 400 kids and I got all the kids to stand up and roar loudly because I smashed a toy chicken with a hammer. That was my little gimmick there. And I was like, I'm just going off there. So I say, like, you know, just got to be yourself. And that's what I've been doing. Just being myself, getting away with it. And, yeah, so I learned from that. And listen to lots of cheesy boy band songs too.
Yay! Shirley?
I'm going to keep it short and I'm going to keep it sweet. All of my favourite failures are just in this book, so... Why don't you just buy it and read it?
Yay.
Oh, it's too funny.
Okay. So we've got 3 minutes to take it home. We're going to make this kind of quick. But in Oliver's book, Oliver writes the character... Well, the Tower... What's the Tower?
What about Tower?
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. is that a poetry night? And it's because poetry's made a real resurgence. It's always been there, but and everyone's. Can you do that when you like something? You click. Do you like that? It's like a beat poem. Some of you aren't clicking, so stop it. Do you understand how this works? You got it. Okay. Now that's the noise you make when. Imagine doing that in bed with your partner. Oh, that's nice.
Worth a try.
We're coming full circle.
I know we do. Oh my God, that's beautiful, Shirley. Although imagine doing that in the bedroom and then suddenly hear heaps more clicking.
Oh, that's not so funny around here because it happens.
Hello.
Oh, yeah, the knee starts clicking instead. So what we're going to do, I'm going to ask each of you your wildest dream really quickly, just a one-sentence dream for what lies ahead. And then we're going to click like that as we like your dream. If you don't like it, don't click, but, you know, click. So judgy. Okay, I'm going to throw over here. Your wildest dream, Shirley.
To be a burger blogger. I stole that from you.
Ah, yes, I think that.
In the future, your wildest dream for Oliver?
To see Taylor Swift in concert, please. That would be a dream come true, yes.
Your wildest dream for the future, Miff?
Oh, to be a hot gossip dancer from the Kenny Everett video show back in the 1970s. I always wanted to be that.
Oh, that's awesome. My wildest dream is that in October we vote yes. Please be part of that change. Okay, thank you so much for being part of this session. Thank you to Miff Warhurst, Oliver Pomervan and Shirley Lee. Please go to the books if you want one. Buy one and they'll be doing their signing. I've got some books there too if you want one, but don't worry about that.